And next on Coast to Coast, as we continue our science theme tonight, we're going to talk about the improbable planet. Dr. Hugh Ross back with us on Coast to Coast, and he's next. Don't go away. Astronomer Hugh Ross, founder, president of Reasons to Believe. Now, that's an organization that is dedicated to integrating scientific fact and biblical faith. It's amazing. His books include Why the Universe is the Way It Is, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, and Navigating Genesis. And this latest one is called Improbable Planet, How Earth Became Humanity's Home. It's a great book. Hugh, welcome back.
Well, thank you.
And I love the fact that you mix really biblical faith along with science, because there is that intertwining, isn't there?
Well, God gave us two books, a book of nature and a book of scripture, and he designed them to cooperate one another.
Yeah, he sure did. What a magnificent universe and planet that we have. What's new with you these days?
Well, what's new is the book, in the sense that recognizing scientifically everything in the universe, every life form that's ever existed on planet Earth, every event geologically in Earth's history plays a crucial role in making possible billions of people living on our planet at one time and developing the technology where they can discover how to have an eternal relationship with their creator.
As we look at this planet and other planets that are out there, are you convinced that we are not alone in the universe?
Well, there is the possibility we might find a planet that could conceivably sustain bacteria for a short period of time and part of its planet. But everywhere we look, we see that there is a hostile environment for advanced life, except here on planet Earth. I mean, we can't even find a star that's sufficiently like the sun that it could be a candidate to have a planet orbiting it on which advanced life could exist.
Now, with planet Earth, did we luck out in terms of the Goldilocks location and things like that?
I think it's more than luck, because there's about 200 different features of our Milky Way galaxy that must be fine-tuned for advanced life to exist here on Earth. Literally every one of our eight planets serves a crucial role in making advanced life possible. I mean, everywhere we look, we see this signature of fine-tuning design. Nothing is there by accident. It all must be exactly the way it is.
Let's talk a little bit more about that, exactly the way it is. How did it become this way?
Well, for example, we noticed that to explain the elements that exist in the crust of the Earth, it's critical that the solar system form much closer to the center of the galaxy, where there'd be the possible enrichment of those heavy elements, but it couldn't stay there. It's a very dangerous place for life to exist, and our Milky Way galaxy received a gravitational ejection from nearby stars and got kicked out from a dangerous zone to a very safe zone, but only after it had been enriched with the appropriate elements that advanced life needs. That's just the beginning. From that point onward, we realized that there was a very special migration of the gas giant planets in our solar system towards the sun, then away from the sun, in order to give us exactly the comet and asteroid belts we need for advanced life. And everywhere we look, we see planetary systems either have no asteroid or comet belts, or they got asteroid and comet belts that are thousands of times bigger than the ones we have. We have the just right comet belts, and the list goes on.
Hugh, can life the way we know it sustain itself in these non-safe zones?
Well, we have my colleagues looking for life in the sense that they're searching for habitable planets. But their definition of habitability is simply a planet that could conceivably have liquid water on its surface at one place at one time. Now, to have liquid water remain there for billions of enough years so that you can go from bacteria to more advanced life forms is much more demanding. But I've written several articles. In fact, there's a whole chapter in my new book, Improbable Planet, where I talk about the fact that there are multiple habitable zones. In addition to the water habitable zone, for example, you've got the ultraviolet habitable zone. A planet must be a sufficient distance from its star that it gets adequate ultraviolet radiation to sustain the building of certain proteins, but not so much that it kills the life form. And for the vast majority of star-planet systems, the ultraviolet habitable zone does not overlap the water habitable zone. And I've written about how there are now 8 known habitable zones. And yes, we have found 3,500 planets outside of our solar system, but the only planet we know of where all 8 habitable zones overlap so that life could conceivably exist is the planet you and I are sitting on.
Hugh, since the beginning of time, mankind has always wondered about their own existence, and the mere fact that you do include biblical information makes this even more critical. There's, to me, there's just no way that life is a fluke of science. I think it needed something else.
I think you're right, because certain basic building block molecules don't exist outside of living systems. For example, nowhere have we found ribose, the 5-carbon sugar that's crucial for making RNA and DNA molecules. We do see it in living systems and a decay product of living systems. Recently, chemists with much technology have made it in the lab, but nowhere do we see it in the natural realm outside of living systems. If there's no ribose, there's no possibility for naturalistic assembly of life. And there are many more elements. For example, there's no basic amino acids that are crucial for making proteins. We don't see those outside of living systems. And furthermore, you can't put the nucleosides together to make the DNA and RNA unless all the ribose sugars are right-handed. And you can't assemble the amino acids to make proteins unless all the amino acids are left-handed. And in the world of nature, outside of biological systems, we see they have a random 50-50 mixture. We see no source where they're all right-handed or they're all left-handed.
Okay, let's talk a little bit about the book, Improbable Planet. Give us a little synopsis, if you would.
Well, a bottom line of the book is many books have been written making the point that you need exquisite design so life can possibly exist on a planet. I take it one step further and say, what kind of design do you need for billions of human beings or their equivalent to live on a planet at one time and develop the technology where they could share the news of how they can come into a relationship with the creator of the universe? And basically, I'm demonstrating the book that the need for fine-tuning design goes up astronomically. I mean, it's such that we recognize that you literally need every component of the universe to be fine-tuned to make that possible. And my goal is that people reading the book would recognize the incredible degree of care and love that was bestowed by the Creator to make it possible for us to sit in this planet, enjoy its beauty, and get the technology where we can actually come, all of us, into the knowledge of how to have that relationship with our Creator. That's just mind-blowing to recognize everything that needs to be done to make that possible.
And the title, of course, Improbable Planet. Tell me about that.
Well, I would have preferred the title Habitability for Redemption, because that's really the focus of the book. What kind of design do you need for a planet to be habitable for human beings in such a way that they could discover the Creator's redemptive offer? And also the book focuses on the fact that we live at a time in the history of the earth where it's more beautiful than it's ever been. And God gave us a capacity to appreciate beauty. There's an aesthetic sense in us human beings. Where did that come from? I look at that as a separate evidence that there must be a God. The fact that we happen to be on the planet in a narrow time window, just 10,000 years wide, where it's incredibly more beautiful than it's ever been before. And he also gave us the aesthetic of beauty to appreciate that. And it's that same beauty that is designed to enable billions of us to live on the planet at one time. I mean, the fact that it all fits together that way screams to me that there's a God out there that really loves us.
I think so. Now, difficult to explain what God is. I know in my days in the Catholic catechism classes, Hugh, they kind of convinced us that God was some guy up there in the clouds, and I don't think it's that way.
Well, I would agree, and what's wonderful about being an astrophysicist is that there are discoveries being made in my discipline that actually not only identify or tell us that there must be a God, but identify exactly what kind of God we're talking about. So, for example, we have space-time theorems that tell us that the creator of the universe is a being that transcends matter, energy, space, and time. So obviously, he's not confined or limited by the space-time dimensions of the universe or its laws of physics. So this tells us something about the power of the creator. Then we look at the fine-tuning design that's necessary to make life possible in the universe. And I've written the book, Why the Universe is the Way It Is, that makes the point that when we examine that fine-tuning design, it allows us to identify specific personal attributes of the creator. I mean, the fact that he is so intimately involved in his creation tells us about his care and his love, his personality, his intellect, his knowledge, his power, his love, his care, and to a degree that isolates the God of the Bible from the gods of the other religions of the world.
And, you know, when you look at the probability of life, that the moon is necessary and it's where it is exactly the way it should be, our distance from the sun, the fact that we have water. I mean, I always use an analogy, Hugh, which is really strange, but every living being and thing on this planet needs water. Grass, trees, plants, animals, people. What are the odds of having a planet that allows clouds to form and rain to fall, which then basically nourishes plants and grass and trees? Because without that process, they'd all die. Now, what are the odds of that happening?
Well, there's also problems if you got too much water. I mean, we've actually found some Earth-like planets, right distance from the star as mm-hmm. the Earth is, right kind of characteristics, most Earth-like. When we measure their water content, they come in at 5 to 50% water. Our planet is 0.03% water. If you got too much water, you never get continents. And if you don't have continents coexisting with oceans on its surface, you can't recycle the nutrients that advanced life needs. And this is what we notice that's unique about the Earth. We have a thin layer of water, the just right thinness to make possible the existence of advanced life. And you mentioned the moon. The moon-forming event stripped our planet of its huge quantity of water. We once had over 1,000 miles deep oceans on our planet, but the moon-forming event caused all that water to leave. Our planet at that time was bone dry, but then we had this thin layer of water replaced by the comet belts of our solar system called the late veneer. So it gave us a thin atmosphere and a thin layer of water, exactly what advanced life needs. And talking about the formation of the moon, I got a chapter in the book where I talk about how the design necessary in the moon-forming event to make advanced life possible on Earth disturbed the people working on the models to such a degree, they said we have to rework the models and find some way to lower all this fine-tuning design. They reworked the models and found that they had even more fine-tuning design than what they started with. This got published in the British journal Nature. They had a long review and several research papers in that journal article, and one of them commented, all these discoveries about the moon-forming event and the increasing design evidence is causing us philosophical disquiet, because basically it's pointing to a supernatural rather than a natural explanation for the moon-forming event.
Without the so-called God, would we be here?
No. I mean, if there was no God, there wouldn't be anything. I mean, the fact that anything even exists is because there's a God that transcends matter, energy, space, and time.
You are a rare scientist. You know that.
Well, I have a lot of colleagues that support what I'm doing. I mean, a lot of people think there are not very many scientists that are committed Bible-believing Christians. They're wrong. There's hundreds of us.
Darwinian evolution versus creationism. Isn't it possible that both can exist at the same time?
Well, we certainly know that Darwinian evolution is responsible for different creatures being able to adapt to their environment. So there's no dispute that we see microevolution. However, it's the macroevolution where we lack the evidence. And I write in the book about these mass extinction and mass speciation events. The fact that we see the Creator removing huge numbers of species from the planet, literally millions, and replacing them with new species. But what you notice is that the new species that replace the species that have gone extinct are a little more efficient at removing greenhouse gases from the atmosphere, which is exactly what you'd expect from a creator that recognizes that the sun is getting progressively brighter and brighter, and therefore it's crucial that life on planet Earth be exactly there at the right time and the right quantity and diversity to perfectly compensate for the changes in the physics of the sun. And I'm convinced that if biologists and astrophysicists were able to discuss this in sufficient detail, the Darwinian models and explanation for all of life history would be out the window.
Do you think, and I talked to an astrobiologist some time ago about the sameness of the primordial soup in the universe, that everything's the same, the elements are the same, you're going to find them on probably all the other planets. And so there's really no big change wherever you may go. So in essence, if you do find a planet like Earth that's got, you know, the same complexities, what are the odds of life like us being developed there?
Well, your astrobiologist friend is correct. And we look at the universe as a whole, it's chemically quite homogeneous. So you're going to find the same elements and chemistry existing everywhere. With one exception, when we look at planet Earth, the elemental abundances are incredibly anomalous on almost every element of the periodic table. So, for example, compared to Mars, we've got 60 times less sulfur. Where you see the greatest anomaly is our planet, compared to what we'd expect in other rocky planets in our galaxy, has 630 times as much thorium and 340 times as much uranium. And because Earth is so extremely rich in uranium and thorium, we have long-lasting plate tectonics and a long-lasting strong magnetic field, which is exactly what you need for a long history of life and the eventual appearance of advanced life.
Just remarkable how it all works, though, and unfolds you, isn't it?
It really is. And what fascinates me is the more I read the scientific literature, the more apparent that conclusion becomes.
They used to say, follow the water, you'll find life. Is that true?
Well, water is one requirement of life. I mean, without liquid water, you're not going to have life. But as I mentioned before, the water habitable zone is only one of eight different known habitable zones. And so it doesn't do any good if you got water on a planet if it's not in the ultraviolet habitable zone, or if it's not in the photosynthetic habitable zone, or if it's not in the atmospheric electric field habitable zone. And the list goes on. And as I said earlier, for all the planets we know of, the planet star system, none of them reside in all eight habitable zones except for planet Earth.
Why us, Hugh?
Why us? Well, you actually have to have the entire universe exactly the way it is, just the right size, just the right mass, just the right age, so that we can exist on this planet. And I believe the why answer is that God created the universe and all of its life, and especially as human beings, to be a tool in his hand to eliminate evil and suffering once and for all, while at the same time enhancing the free will capacity of beings that choose to have a relationship with their creator. That's why the universe exists, and that's why we exist.
Well, it's going to happen indeed, and it's remarkable how it all seems to unfold. And is there a closeness now, like you were mentioning, that some scientists are beginning to accept your thoughts? Is that growing?
I do see it growing, and it's growing where people are involved in interdisciplinary research. I mean, one of the problems with scientists, to be successful, you have to hyper-specialize. But the danger of that is when you hyper-specialize, you're not aware of how all these different scientific disciplines integrate together to show you why the universe, the Earth, and life on Earth looks the way it does.
Stay with us. We're coming back for more on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast to Coast. Dr. Hugh Ross with us. We'll take phone calls next hour with Hugh. His book is called Improbable Planet. And Hugh, the book is available on Amazon.com. How about bookstores? Is it out?
Well, it will be released tomorrow. That's the release date, and but you can already get it through Amazon.com and through our
Super.
Reasons.org website.
Timing is perfect. The other planets, for example, in our solar system, do you think, like Mars, that it once possessed life, intelligent life?
I don't think so. However, I've been on record since 1988. We will find the remains of life on every solar system body. And that's simply because life has been so prolific on planet Earth for such a long period of time that literally millions of tons of Earth's soil have been transported to the moon and the other planets and the moons of Jupiter and Saturn. That transport takes place whenever a meteor of sufficient size strikes the Earth. It causes Earth's soil to escape Earth's gravity. So, for example, I spoke at NASA Houston a few years ago, urging them to go back to the moon because the fossils of Earth's first life have been destroyed by Earth's violent geology. But moon has virtually no geology. We can go to the moon and we will find the pristine fossils of Earth's first life. And by examining those fossils, we'll know who got the origin of life model right, whether the theists were right or the atheists were right. Last time I checked, that made up 100% of the U.S. taxpayer base. So all of us should have a vested interest in going back to the moon and recovering the fossils of Earth's first life.
What do you find when you were putting together Improbable Planet? What was the one single thing, Hugh, that just was mind-boggling, even for you?
What was mind-boggling for me was a recognition that everything in creation is tied to redemption. You know, as I read through the Bible over again, I recognized that God's works of redemption preceded his works of creation, and that everything God creates is for the purpose of making possible a huge number of human beings coming into redemptive relationship with their creator, which caused me to go back into the scientific literature and say, is that really true? And so I began reading the scientific literature and recognized what the Bible declared thousands of years ago indeed is correct. Every event in the creation history, the universe, the solar system, and the life on planet Earth plays a role in making possible the redemption of billions of human beings. And so I understand creation in a way that I never understood it before.
When you read Genesis and reread it and read it again, you know, you see the segmentation of how things formed in the universe, and it makes a lot of sense. What I don't understand is how they put it down in a weak form, you know, day one, day two. Why did they do that?
Well, in the Hebrew language, they have a very limited vocabulary. Biblical Hebrew has only 3,000 words if you don't count the names of people and cities. And therefore, in Hebrew, there is no word for an epoch of time. What they use is the word yom, which has four distinct literal definitions: part of the daylight hours, all of the daylight hours, a 24-hour period, or an epoch of time. So Moses had no other way of describing seven consecutive epochs of time except to use the word day. It's the limit of the language.
But with this, okay, so let's assume that we're talking about, what, billions of years of formation, realistically?
Correct.
Okay. What about the other planetary systems that started earlier than we did? We're 4.5 billion years old. The universe is 14 billion years old. There's, you know, 10 billion years of a jump start there. Did those planets form 10 billion years ago? I mean, how long is the evolution of a planetary system? When is it birthed?
Well, to get planets where life is possible, you need three consecutive generations of stars. So our star, the Sun, is a third-generation star. And I just wrote a blog article for our website at reasons.org discussing a research paper that made the point that you cannot get advanced life showing in the history of the universe any earlier than we human beings. Therefore, we have to be the first intelligent species that exists in the universe. Simply because you need a minimum of 13.8 billion years just to get one species of intelligent life existing. And the paper was making the point that, you know, given what we see in the physics of the universe, there's a possibility that you could have future intelligent civilizations, but we have to be the first on the scene.
Now, that's an interesting. Why do you think they use that formula of time in order to, why not say life forms a billion years after the universe was
formed? Well, for example, and it's something I wrote about in Why the Universe is the Way It is that for advanced life to be possible, the planet must be super endowed with uranium and thorium. That's what you need to get the plate tectonics operating, then make any field established. But that the history of uranium and thorium formation increases as the universe gets older and older until such a point where star formation begins to subside, and then the uranium and thorium begins to decay away. Bottom line, uranium and thorium hit a peak abundance in the ashes of the universe when the universe is about 9 billion years old. And so if you want a planet with adequate uranium and thorium, it must appear about 4.5 billion years ago. And therefore, it's no coincidence that we live in a planet that's 4.5 billion years old. That's exactly the age you would want in order for uranium and thorium to be at a peak abundance. And then you have to add the 9 billion years to that, because that's the time you need to build up that uranium and thorium. That's just a few of the evidences that we have that establish we must be the first on the scene. But that evidence also tells us we're probably the last, because uranium and thorium is going to decay as the universe gets older and older. And so the mistake of this research paper that I wrote a blog article on is they were correct in saying we have to be the first, but they missed the fact that because of the uranium and thorium decay, it's also clear we are the last.
Now, how does that explain all these UFO cases, Hugh, where, you know, if they're real, and some of them may be, that they possess technology way beyond us, which to me backs up the theory that they've been around a much longer time period than we have been?
Well, the Bible tells us that God created two distinct species of intelligent life, human beings that are constrained by the physics of the universe, and angels that are not constrained by the physics and dimensions of the universe. And we got another book out called Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men, where we look at the evidence for UFOs. And as an astronomer, I've been processing UFO reports since I was 16 years of age. And 99% of them I'm able to explain as natural phenomena, you know, military aircraft, or hoaxes, but there's a 1% residual. And what's interesting about that 1% residual, we can prove that they are real, but at the same time, we can prove that they're non-physical. But because I'm a Christian, I believe in the reality of non-physical things that are real. For example, we see about 2,000 UFO crash sites. When you go to the crash site, there is no debris. And yet we can see the ground has been depressed, snow has melted, if there's snow there, vegetation is damaged. Something obviously happened.
Yes.
That was caused by something real, but there's no physical artifacts. And when you have an observation of the UFO going through the sky and crashing into the earth, no sonic boom and no evidence of heat friction as it goes through the atmosphere. A physical object will give you a sonic boom and heat friction. But the thing we notice about angels is that they are non-physical beings that are real. In the book, I describe what happens when people have close encounters with these UFOs. It's 100% deleterious. It's never beneficial. The best you're going to come away with is recurring terrifying nightmares. The worst case, people have actually been killed by these encounters. And the thing you notice, too, is in these close encounters where there's a transmission of information, is that the technology is something that violates what we know about the laws of physics. So yes, there's an appearance of technology, but it's not the kind of technology that we're familiar with. And the other thing we notice is that when there's communication, it's a deceptive message. I mean, what I've noticed in the UFO phenomena, it's been around and documented history for over 3,000 years. But you see an evolution in these UFO encounters. You know, they start off as little leprechauns, then they become slow-moving dirigibles in the atmosphere 150 years ago, World War II. They were foo-foo fighters moving at just under the speed of sound. Today, they're moving at 25,000 miles per hour. They're keeping pace with human technology. And when they communicate what's going on in the universe, their astronomy is more advanced than the lay public, but always behind the experts. So, for example, 100 years ago, these beings claimed to be from the backside of the moon. But when the lay public recognized that wasn't credible, then they said they were from Venus. And when the lay public recognized how hot it is on the surface of Venus, they said they were from Mars and the moons of Jupiter. The story you get now is that they're from another planetary system. So the fact that they keep changing their story. And what's also interesting is when they communicate philosophy, it's all focused on denying the deity of Jesus Christ. The Urantia book, which is a 4,000-page book communicated to humans by so-called UFO beings, a third of the content of the book is focused on denying the deity of Jesus Christ. So these UFO beings have a religious agenda, but we're warned in the Bible that's exactly what we would expect from the fallen angels, the angels that rebelled against God's authority.
So you subscribe to the theory, much like the Bible, that these events did happen.
Right.
They could have been extraterrestrial as opposed to spiritual, but will we ever get that answer?
Well, there have been six physicists that I cite in Lights in the Sky and Little Green Men who devoted more than a decade of research studying these UFOs. All of us agree that there's a one-to-one correspondence to what you see in these residual UFOs, the ones that are real, and what you see in the occult and demonic phenomena. And so they agree with me that there's trans-dimensional beings that are responsible for this. We're not talking physical aliens. We're talking aliens that transcend the space-time dimensions of the universe.
Remarkable. And the work is remarkable. How long did it take you to put together Improbable Planet?
It was 5 years of research. I mean, you know, first I went through the Bible and discovered this consistent link between redemption and creation. And then I spent literally 5 years going through the scientific literature, putting that to the test. And then when I saw it all fitting, I said, someone's got to write a book on this. And people said, well, Hugh, you're the one that needs to do it.
How unique is intelligent life, Hugh?
Well, I think we're the only physical intelligent life existing in the entire universe.
Wow.
And one thing that persuades me of that is a universe any smaller would not give rise to us. It literally takes a universe of exactly the size and mass that we observe in order to make possible one intelligent species on one planet. So that tells us the entire universe exists to make a home for humanity.
That's a pretty dramatic statement, Mr. Ross.
Well, it tells us just how important we human beings are in the creation scheme. We're the epitome.
If these other planetary systems continue to get found at the rate that we're finding them, and you talked about how life on other planets in our solar system eventually will get found. What kind of life do you think that would have been?
Well, it'd be bacterial. I mean, every ton of Earth's soil contains about 100 quadrillion bacteria. And so if we go to the surface of Mars, we go to the surface of the moon, we will find the remains of those bacteria. I mean, for example, colleagues of mine have calculated that there's 20,000 kilograms of Earth's soil on every 100 square kilometers of the moon. So the moon's going to be the best place to find this stuff. If you go to Mars, we're looking at only 200 kilograms for every 100 square kilometers. So it's going to be much more challenging to find it on Mars. But if we look hard enough, we will find it there.
Why doesn't that excite me, the fact that you would find bacteria on other planets? See, I'm looking for squirrels and fish, and to me, that's life.
Well, that is. But one thing I write about in the Improbable Planet, if you don't have 3 billion years of only bacteria and other unicellular life forms in the face of the earth, there is no possibility you'll ever get plants and animals. There's a reason why you don't see plants and animals until 575 million years ago. Because unless you have 3 billion years of bacterial activity, the soil won't support those kinds of life forms, and you won't have the right chemistry in the atmosphere to support those life forms. One thing we notice is the planet had about 1% oxygen or less for almost all of its history. And then because of all that bacteria, there was a time when it jumped from 1% to 8%. The moment it hit 8%, we got animals proliferating in the oceans. And when it hit 10% shortly thereafter, we now have complex animals. Where literally every phylum of animal life we see in the planet today was brought into existence, including the chordates, the phyla that all of us are part of.
Hugh, isn't it kind of sad to think of us as being the only ones out there?
Well, as I mentioned, we're not the only ones. There's also angels that transcend our space-time dimensions. They're not constrained by the universe. But what we're told is that God created the universe and us human beings to be instruments to bring about the end of all evil and suffering, not only in the universe, but in the angelic realm as well. And the Bible tells us that the righteous angels are intently watching us human beings to learn about the redemptive plan that God's putting into effect, to learn about the grace of God. We get to experience it as human beings. They have to simply watch it. And for that reason, once evil and suffering have been completely conquered and removed, God's going to elevate us human beings where we will be judges and rulers and teachers of the angels. So we're going through a training program. It's like going through an advanced graduate program. We're being prepared for future careers.
It's pretty dramatic, isn't it?
It is.
It's exciting at the same time, isn't it, Hugh?
It is a thrill. I mean, to recognize what God has done in order to make possible our existence and how He plans to use us in the future, yeah, it's a mind-boggling thing to conceive of.
Well, with Dr. Hugh Ross and, of course, Hugh's website, a couple of them are linked up at coasttocoastam.com, and you've got a Facebook page going too now, don't you?
I have a Facebook page and a Twitter page where I answer people's questions and keep them informed of the latest scientific discoveries that give more evidence for the Christian faith. And of course, we have reasons.org, our website, where we archive all of our articles and podcasts.
Were we lucky, Hugh?
More than lucky,
And
we're
again,
all part of God's fine-tuned design. But yeah, I mean, we're blessed beyond imagine. And I look at our planet as being extravagantly designed to bless us human beings. God didn't have to give us such a beautiful planet. He didn't have to give us such a rich treasure chest of resources, but He did because of His care and love for each one of us.
where did the hatred and bitterness come from? Stick around, Hugh. We're going to come back and have you answer that question. And also, we'll take phone calls in our final hour here on Coast to Coast AM. And we've got a Facebook page too, folks. So make sure you like us at coasttocoastam.com at our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter as well.